Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. I'm pleased to welcome today Dr. Claire Thigh-Vassallo, who is here to talk about an EU project entitled Cementi. And I hope we will speak about that and a few other things as well. I'd like to just outline a little bit Dr. Thigh-Vassallo's academic career so far. She graduated from the University of Malta with a BA General in Philosophy and English Literature with Linguistics and a BA Honours in English with Linguistics. She pursued her interest in the interface between these three areas at the Istituto di Comunicazione, Università degli Studi di Bologna, Italy, where she obtained her doctorate in semiotics under the tutorship of no less Professor Umberto Eco. The emphasis of her research was in the field of semiotics as literary and cultural theory and as cognitive process. She's presently senior lecturer in English and translation studies at the University of Malta. She teaches courses in feminist literary theory, gender and power, multilingualism and multiculturalism, and translation theory, amongst others. Lately, she has been appointed chairman of the Public Broadcasting Service, PBS, for television and radio. It was in June, where she has previously served as a member of the board of directors. A very warm welcome to you, Dr. Thigh-Vassallo.
Thank you.
So, what exactly is Cementi?
So, Cementi is, I think, a very interesting project. It's in its third year. It's one of these EU projects, sort of on the Erasmus model, but with a difference. It's an Erasmus Mundus project, which encourages European students to move out of Europe and non-Europeans to move into Europe, because that sort of knowledge is also seen to be very important. We need to be out there, and we need to have mainly it works with Australia, Canada, China, and America. It's good for people from all of these huge and important nations to also have an idea when they're young, when they're students, of what it's like to live in a European country.
So in this particular case, it's Canada that was interested the project. And who else is involved?
So it's very modest project in terms of some of the big European ones. This only involves six universities. On the European side, it's coordinated by the University of Bologna. I keep very close links with Bologna, and I'm very pleased I do, because it also opens doors to such things. So, it's good to continue to develop and to work on the connections one makes when studying away, and not to just leave them behind, because they really can take you.
Networking.
Oh, yes.
Starts early
it
and
does.
Continues.
It does. And even these exchanges, they make contacts which they can build on later. But so Bologna is key to many of these projects. And in fact, it is the coordinator. And there are only three European universities: as Bologna, Malta, and Athens. And on the Canadian side, the coordinator is the University of York in Toronto. And it's also, the other two are Trent University, which is just outside of Toronto, and the University of Prince Edward Island, which is, again, another island. So there's a sort of similarity between Malta and Prince Edward Island, which came up very strongly.
What would be the aims of this particular project in general?
So the full title, Cementi, stands for Canada Exchanges with the Mediterranean, Mediterranean Experiences and Their Impact on Nationalism, Transnationalism and Identity. But in brief, what it's really about is migration. Migration as an issue that's very pressing in Europe at present, but migration as an issue that's happened in waves through the history of man. I mean, you can talk about our history in terms of waves of people moving, conquering, exploring. Well, it still goes on in different forms. And in Europe, we know we're having this problem of people leaving Africa, North Africa, and coming towards Europe. And Canada have had a history based on migration of people from Europe. So here we have people coming into Europe, and places like Canada are formed by people coming out of Europe. So what happened to Canada, you know, over the years? How have these different ethnicities coexisted? What problems, what issues? Thing is, Canada is perceived to be a very positive model of people coming together, finding a shared identity while also preserving their original ethnic identity, and that's why Canada.
And who's involved in this? I mean, is it just the students? How do you go about, for example, inviting the students to apply for something like this?
So I could say that the project is in two phases. A very large first phase, which centered on the students. We had a total of 54 placements, 54 possible students traveling from Canada to Europe and Europe to Canada. At intervals here, since I'm coordinating the project, I would put a call on the NOC, on SIMS,
News on Campus,
News on Campus and various structures that we have here at university to inform students of the opportunity. It was offered mainly to students in the Faculty of Arts, Education, and there was a special interest to try and attract students from the Mediterranean Institute for obvious reasons. The students most interested were those from international relations, however. Those are the ones who applied most frequently, and they're the ones who took most of the opportunities.
And what did they actually have to achieve themselves? What did they have to do, the students, to participate?
They simply had to show that they were interested and had to be willing to take on an adventure.
Which lasted how long?
Only 4 months, a semester. To take on a whole semester to fit into the space that a Canadian student would vacate, and to follow a whole semester of courses as any other Canadian student would. So to fit right into that system and see it from the inside. Part of the value of these courses, these exchanges, is that you end up going to places that you wouldn't normally choose to go. Prince Edward Island is hardly on anybody's list of must, you know, see before I die places. And neither is Trent, incidentally. But that is part of the value, because you will go to the other places if you want to. But here we're going to take you to places you wouldn't choose to go. And you're going to see things from, you know, from a place that's so totally different, covered in snow, dead cold, a totally different experience. And they go alone. So they have to make friends. They have to find their way. They find their coordinator, look for their courses. And it's a really useful experience. You learn to land on your feet.
And what about the courses? Did they have to take particular types of courses?
They were free to follow the courses they would be taking here, so the sort of equivalent for the most part. But they had two obligations. One was to take a course there that dealt with issues of migration. It could be historical migration, present migration issues, issues of identity, ethnicity, something directly that pertains to the Chimenti ideas. And at the end of their experience, they have to write a report. And the report is in two parts. There's a strong academic side where the student would describe the course he or she took and recommend useful and interesting books to deal with that area. And the other part of the report is very personal, describing the experience, meeting people, going out, the weather, the problems, the fun bits. And they have to submit that before the whole exchange is through. And then we are collecting these 54 reports, putting them online as part of the material we are gathering on this experience.
And when you say our students went to Canada, well, I presume that Canadian students came to Europe, not all of them probably to the University of Malta.
So quite a few came here. As it turns out, one of the problems with the project, which was unpredictable, is that Athens University was on strike for about a year and a half. So that put a, you know, that obviously meant that no students could go there in all of that time. And some went to Bologna. However, there were problems with language. We imagined that Canadian students would still have enough knowledge of either Greek or Italian, if that was their ethnic background, to take courses in these universities. But their knowledge of the language, it turns out, well, at least those who applied, wasn't actually good enough. So there was a great demand for students to come here. So we always had the full complement of Canadian students because we have this massive advantage in the Mediterranean that we have English. We have our own language. We have this international language that gives us a place above, makes us a very obvious and desirable choice and gives us an edge.
And the Canadian students that you were involved with, the ones that came here to Malta, what would you say about their experiences?
Very interesting, very varied. So we had students from York, so from the city, Toronto, and from Prince Edward Island. So there was the island mentality that there were some similarities there that were quite interesting, although such different islands. And one from Trent, who's spending the whole year. They found a lot of things surprising and funny and strange and different. They found that Maltese students, for instance, were polite but kept very much to themselves. They found it far easier to make friends with other foreign students. In a way, that's understandable because all the foreign students are looking for the same thing, whereas the local students are totally settled. They all live at home. They have their normal circle of friends. But that was something they mentioned very often. They were surprised at incidents of racism. For instance, this one student, Brent, who was going into a club in Parcherville with an American, a black American, had a horrible experience when this American friend of his was punched in the nose and told to keep out. And he raised it in the newspapers. He wrote a letter. And then when the next student came from Prince Edward University, and this student happened to be black, Brent, who had just returned, tried to talk him out of it. Don't go there. So this guy came fully warned, and I'm pleased to say he didn't actually have any incidents. Because the issue is migration, and when these Canadian students come here, we could offer them two things. Not only interesting academic courses on Mediterranean issues and migration through the years, but hands-on experience at the detention centres. We have this problem we're facing with illegal migration and with detention centres in certain parts of Malta.
Just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm speaking to Dr. Claire Thaik-Vassallo about a EU project that she's been involved in called Cementi. Yes, you were saying about their opting to actually visit detention centres.
Specifically these centres where they wanted to meet these migrants and listen firsthand to what problems they faced and why they left in the first place. It's difficult and tough. But really what they did, most of the different students who came, was offer to teach English to the migrants, just giving some basic lessons. Again, this is, English is perceived to be the biggest asset you can have to get by internationally. And these students felt they could share this with the migrants recently arrived. I suppose it's something that most of us could do if we really wanted to.
And was there a good response from the detention centres?
Very good. They came back very positive. They were also shocked that they were detained in the first place. They couldn't understand that. But that's something they discussed with their lecturers. And, it's not an easy issue. And they learned to appreciate that.
at the end of the day, I mean, a wonderful project like this, which produces so much information, must really be fruitful. I always worry a little bit that somehow the information, the analysis then that's made afterwards is not going to get out to the right people. How have you managed in this project to make sure that all the richness of the project is actually offered as information to people outside?
Well, really, I suppose we're keeping it within the universities, because the second part of the project, now that the student exchange has mainly come to an end, is to put together a joint curriculum between all of these six universities and all of the course coordinators who took part. We met recently in December in Bologna to organize all this material into workable units that can eventually be a course that can be taught either at any of the Mediterranean universities or any of the three Canadian ones. And we also plan to use virtual means where perhaps students can follow without even having to be in one of the universities. It's the full structure of this side of things is under construction, so I'm not exactly sure how it will turn out.
But it will be that the curriculum will be based on the experiences of both the students and those who have been following the course.
Yes, the student experiences are an important part of it, and then we're also building up issues where we can, you know, go into our own competencies on, you know, cultural, in my case, I'm going to draw up the part on cultural exchange, on issues of differences in language, differences in culture, multiculturalism, multilingualism, this sort of area that I teach anyway at the university here. I will also be drawing upon to put together this curriculum. So it's something between the students' experiences and the courses they took, and the competencies of the different coordinators, which, I mean, we came into the project because we had these areas of interest in the first place.
This is one of the wonderful things about these projects. I think that, as you say, this experience is going to inform your approach to your own lectures, whether they're part of this curriculum or not. So
yeah,
you will be gaining from it. The students will be gaining from it. In general, the universities involved will be gaining from it. So it's sort of, it's a win-win.
Absolutely. I totally encourage these projects. They're externally funded. They provide opportunities that are really difficult, I mean, to come up with on your own. You know, you need the funding. There's a lot of enthusiasm. They have long-lasting effects. I mean, on each of these 54 students, I mean, they've all been somewhere. They've met people. They've got a network that they had never had before. They can follow up. Even if they don't do anything with it, it's enriched them and added to their experience.
One of the things which cropped up as you were talking in more than one part of this discussion has been this fact that English is so key to student education. I know that you're involved or have been involved in the setting up of the English speaking union section here in Malta. What are the aims of this initiative?
Malta has an advantage, a very clear one, that we have an international language as well as a very strong local language. If you look at EU documents on multilingualism, for instance, the Armin Maalouf report published only last year, it's encouraging every European citizen to have not only two languages but three, to take on what he calls a personal adoptive language, take on another language that's not obvious, in our case not necessarily Italian as our third language but Chinese. Now, give yourself an edge, take on something else. But there he's talking about the third language, that we should all at least have more than one. Now we're in this fantastic situation where we have a strong and beautiful local language and access to the world's first language, first in terms of its spread, global spread. So we need to protect both of these assets equally. The English-speaking Union is an organization, obviously based in Britain, far-reaching throughout the Commonwealth, which helps provide assistance in preserving English, to provide people of all ages with competitions, reasons to use the language, debating, exchanges, visits to other places, and encouraging the actual use of the language and to recognize its value. Its value as, frankly, value added. Our university in this project, for instance, was the one everybody wanted to come to. We're a good university, we have a lot to offer, but the fact that we offer it in English puts us out there. And, you know, we should not underestimate that. We should encourage the use of English as a way of being both international and national.
I know you're also involved, or I think you're the president of the British Cultural Association. That is an association that has for many years been encouraging English cultural contacts with Britain. I know that there is perhaps a discussion about how an association like that might be presenting itself, for example, to the general public in Malta. Perhaps, I mean, I'm throwing this out as a point of discussion, perhaps the way in which it has been presented has not sort of been as effective as it could be.
I think it's an interesting moment. There seem to be a lot of initiatives to promote English, not as English culture. We need to break that link. English is a world language, doesn't need to come from Britain. But we have very close connections with Britain, so it's a useful way of, you know, promoting it. But it doesn't have to be restricted in that way. The BCA, British Cultural Association, has a very particular history in that when the British Council was asked to leave in 1979, the gap was addressed by Marjorie Mortimer, who had suggested and, in fact, managed to organise this association to take up some of the activities that the British Council used to do. It's continued to work since 79, but on quite a low key, quite a low profile. And yet it's had a presence in schools. We've had an annual essay competition since 1979. We've had speaking competitions. We've done a lot with school children, and we also have public lectures and drama and other sorts of events. But now, looking at the English Speaking Union, which is larger and, you know, international and has a significant presence, we find that there are lots of the same sorts of activities being promoted by both. So perhaps these are ways of creating synergies, and us working with the ESU and the ESU working with all the other organizations doing similar things locally. But together, perhaps, now we can have a more noticeable presence.
The issue of bilingualism, of course, has many different facets. It's not an easy thing to discuss. There are historical and cultural parts of it that are quite difficult to cope with. I've interviewed, for example, communication therapist Dr. Helen Gregg, and she was talking about the way in which children take on two languages, that perhaps in the past there has been a bit of a worry on the side of parents about not making their children bilingual because they're not going to learn either of them very well or something like that. And she actually said that recent research shows that is actually, in fact, not true, that children can cope extremely well with bilingualism. And I think these are messages that have to come out to the general public that need to be put across. I know that you're a senior lecturer in the translating and interpreting department, which is quite a new department that embodies a bit this bilingualism. How do you see this growing in Malta as an idea, the idea of real proper bilingualism?
Well, as you say, the Translation and Interpreting Studies Department was only set up last year as a full-time day course option. And it builds precisely on this skill that a lot of us have, of being comfortable and fluent in our two languages. And there's a whole, you know, profession out there that people can use this skill at, in, whether it's translating or interpreting. Definitely, there have been fears about children learning two languages and not learning them well, and enough studies to show that children are able to separate the two languages that they're learning. However, the particular danger in Malta is that many of us do not separate the two languages, and you know, you can open a huge debate on that. I think we have a way of speaking to each other where we draw on both, and it's quite natural to us. And to say that it shouldn't be allowed is, you know, you don't want language police. What we need is citizens, people, to be comfortable in either language, Maltese or English, where only one is acceptable. For instance, if you go abroad, you can't rely on your Maltese phrases. So your English has to be good enough. But when we're speaking to each other, nobody has the right to tell us how we should or shouldn't speak.
This brings me to the last thing that I would like to talk to you about, PBS. It's very interesting that an academic from the university should have been offered this position. Why do you feel they would have gone for an academic?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people here with very interesting backgrounds. Here specifically we're talking about media. We have very strong communications department. We have a lot of people with relevant background. And I think increasingly industry is looking at the university and seeing that there are people here who are relevant to what's happening out there. The idea of the academic being cocooned in some ivory tower is really an image of the past. We feed off each other all the time. In my particular case at PBS, I was asked to join the board in 2000. So off and on, I've been there for about 8 years. It's a very particular place. And so having had some years experience, probably it was part of the reason I was asked to take on the job.
Well, for reasons of time, PBS and language will have to be the subject of our next program. Thank you so much, Dr. Teg Vassallo, for coming to talk to us today.